Yeah, this is Penn Jillette, you know, the big guy, Penn and Teller, from Las Vegas, Nevada, sitting here with Michael Goudeau, my co-host and celebrated juggler of the Lance Burton Show, and I am just about trembling.
Yeah, about to pass out.
I believe I have never been more nervous in an interview. We've been billboarding this interview for months now, I think since we started the show. I think we can say that we have on the phone my biggest hero, yours too, Goudeau?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. The humiliating thing is that I just found out who he was like 10 years ago. I should have known from the moment I was in grade school. They should have talked about him all the time, and we should have had to memorize everything he's done. I just read the book, The Man Who Fed the World, by Leon Hesser, who's also on the phone. And you might want to call this number, 866-570-PEN, that's 7366, 866-570-PEN, that's 7366, or Gmail is penradio@gmail.com, penradio.com. You might want to call before you have a question and make up the question as you go, because you're going to want to be able to say to your grandkids that you actually talked to this man. We have here, no qualifications whatsoever, my biggest hero in the world, Dr. Norman Borlaug. Are you there? Are the phones working, Doctor?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
It's and Leon, you also there?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think maybe I'll let you explain why you should be the biggest hero to everyone, Dr. Borlaug. What did you have to do with the Green Revolution, and what did that mean to planet Earth?
Well, the Green Revolution was the spreading high-yield technology, which I and my team had been involved in developing, spreading it to the developing countries of Asia, especially first to Pakistan and India, later to a number of other countries in Asia like Turkey, Iran, later to China, and also to Latin American countries.
And this included
developing high-yielding varieties that had the potential to produce high grain yields per acre, but at the same time it had to be coupled with good crop management, restoring soil fertility, controlling weeds and pests and so on, and then getting economic policies established by governments which permitted the small farmer to adopt the technology.
And how many people do they estimate that you and your gang, with this technology and the fertilizer and the government programs, how many lives do they estimate you save from starvation?
Well, there's no way of really measuring the numbers, but you see numbers cast around of several hundred millions of people. But this came on stream into wide-scale production at a time when hunger and starvation were strong and threatening and getting worse in India in the middle 60s, and to Pakistan to a somewhat lesser extent, but it was probably even worse in China, but at that time we didn't have access to Chinese information.
Now, what did it feel like? It was 1970 that you won the Nobel Prize, is that right?
Right.
And what did that feel like to win the Nobel? Did you have an inkling you were going to win it?
No, of course not. No one had ever won a Nobel Prize for work in agriculture and food production. And the way the Nobel Prizes are structured, the only window through which someone working in food and agriculture could qualify was through the window of peace.
Mm-hmm. So you won the Nobel Peace Prize for feeding people.
Yes.
Okay, and now you have you want to talk a little bit about the world food prize, or do you want to talk about that, Leon? I want to talk to Leon a little bit. We called him. How you doing, Leon?
Oh, just fine, thank you.
I loved the book you wrote on Norman, which is called The Man Who Fed the World. And you talk a lot about, the last third of the book or so, you're talking an awful lot about the World Food Prize that kind of solves this gap in the Nobel Prize. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yes. Well, a few years after Norman won the Nobel Peace Prize, he went back to the Nobel Committee and said, you really should have a Nobel Food Prize. And they said, well, based on Alfred Nobel's will, we cannot do that. So Norman looked around and finally found a multimillionaire who happened to be born in Iowa, the same year that Norman was born in Iowa, 1914.
That was a good year in Iowa for people, wasn't it?
Yes.
That was a bumper crop year for people in Iowa.
Right. And they struck up a friendship, and John Ruin said, I will finance it. And this year in October will be the 20th anniversary of the World Food Prize. And the prize is given to the person, or in some cases, two persons in the world who have done the most to increase the quantity or quality of food for poor people.
I want to ask one question kind of both of you. I don't know the exact year, so please forgive me, and you'll probably be able to fill it in. But Paul Ehrlich wrote the book, The Population Bomb, the end of the 60s or very early 70s, right?
Yes, and it was about 1966 or 1967. In fact, there were two books written at that time, which in effect said, let's give up on India. It's hopeless. They cannot produce enough food, and we cannot provide them enough as gift. The United States had been providing 5 or 6 million tons a year to try to keep them from starving. That was the sentiment when Norman Borlaug's technology was introduced in India and Pakistan.
Now, Paul Ehrlich just wrote this book, The Population Bomb, and as far as I know, at least 5 or 6 years ago, it was still used as textbooks, and you'd still see it quoted often in, like, the New York Times and places. Either one of you or both of you, could you help explain any guess on why that book remains so popular and why it's so wrong?
Well, first of all, had there not been change in agricultural productivity, that is, yields of basic food per acre of cultivated land, the predictions that he made were true, because we were running out of the ability, as had been the case all down through history. As more food was needed, more land was open to cultivation. But in many countries of the world, at the beginning, right after World War II, there was no more land really suitable for agriculture that could be open to cultivation to increase productivity, as had been done for thousands and thousands of years since the beginning of agriculture. And so this increased productivity, due to the development of science and technology, high-yielding varieties, how to restore soil fertility to worn-out soils, how to control weeds and insect pests, and finally to demonstrate what that package was able to do on thousands of small plots on farmers' fields, so that you could get modifications in government economic policies, such as the availability of fertilizer, the credit for the small farmer to buy that fertilizer at time of planting and pay for it at harvest, and then a fair price at harvest that reflected the international price of the wheat or maize or rice at that particular time. All of those pieces had to come together.
And now, why don't you give us... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, so go on. Why don't you give us a little idea of what the difference in yield in when the Green Revolution really exploded? What was the difference in yield per acre? How much more food did the dwarf species and so on, and the fertilizer and the government programs allow farms? What factor did it jump up by?
Okay, in the case of Pakistan and India, when this technology was first increased or introduced experimentally on experiment stations and a bit later on small farms, with the old varieties and the old practices, even under irrigation, yields were on the order of 10 to 11 bushels per acre of wheat. With the new technology, the package together, all of it manipulated and managed properly, would produce 75, 85 bushels per acre instead of 10 or 11. So it was many-fold. And the when you've got a package of practices like this and demonstrate it on 10,000 or many thousands of small plots on farmers' fields, not on experiment stations. These are little farmers. They may be illiterate, can't read or write, but they know exactly what that implication is from the standpoint of feeding their families better and having something to sell and to begin to buy some of the basic needs. And that's what happened.
Yeah, and that is a big jump. We'll give people a moment to crawl back onto their chairs after that. But do you
and
think...
And, of course, when this was going on, these two books that Leon Hesser has just mentioned, Population Monster by Paul Ehrlich and the one by Famine 1975 by the Paddock brothers, were a burden that was we were carrying on our backs when it came to try to modify pricing policies, economic policies that permitted these small farmers to adopt the new technology. All of this was extra weight on our back.
Now, what I find interesting is, as you said, those two books, Paul Ehrlich's book, and the brothers' book, were accurate if there had not been a Green Revolution. What fascinates me is the number of people that still quote those books and still act like the Green Revolution didn't happen. Do you have some sort of feeling on why people like to talk doomsday when there should have been a huge celebration for the work you did? Not that you would have participated in the celebration, you're too busy working, but for the rest of us, those of us who are lazy, why isn't everyone celebrating the Green Revolution as much as I think they should?
I think that because of the fact the Green Revolution didn't solve all the hunger and famine problems in the world. There are still large numbers of people who are hungry and sometimes verging on famine. For example, sub-Saharan Africa has been all of those 35, 40 countries. Food production per acre of the basic crops has been going down for the last three decades. And this is one of the areas where we're still struggling to get moving in changing this technology. But even in India today, there's still a lot of poverty. People still with their hands out begging for money to buy more food. In China, they have done a much better job of distributing the food more equitably than in India. And I think part of that is because of the lack of general education in India, because in China, from the time of fairly early on, primary schools were available to virtually all children in the areas, except those in very isolated mountainous areas. And this has continued to provoke a better understanding of all of these problems.
Now,
and
why...
I can, You see, I'm conditioned by this hunger and misery, poverty, back home here in our own country, in the deep depths of the Depression of the early 1930s. I saw it. I saw the banks go broke in rural areas. There was food everywhere. People were in the cities. My first visit to Minneapolis was a horrifying experience in 1933. Hundreds of people with their hands out asking for nickels to buy bread. Unemployment everywhere.
And do you think we've hit our head? The Green Revolution went and turned, many factors from, as you said, up to like 80 bushels an acre. Do you think we can do more than that? I mean, the population of Earth is supposed to level off at about 10 billion. Is it possible for the Earth to feed 10 billion people?
I say yes, but the more difficult of that problem is to distribute that food equitably once it's produced. But in order to make sure that we're going to be able to produce that 10 million without destroying the environment, we have to have continuing good funding on a stable, continuing basis for additional research. And the new biotechnology or transgenic movement of genes across borders that were impossible before modern technology of the last 25 years is important to this meeting the target.
I'm going to take a little break now. I want to tell people that my guests are Dr. Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, has fed hundreds of millions of people by kickstarting the Green Revolution and still continues at 92 years old to work to feed the world. My other guest is Leon Hesser, who wrote the book The Man Who Fed the World, which is a biography of Dr. Norman Borlaug. And they're both here. They're both guests. When we come back after this, I want to talk about environmentalism, because there's some people, environmentalists, who think that some of this genetic modifying and all the stuff that's being done may not be good for the planet. And there's also people that are just against genetically modified food, as we call Frankenfood. And we want to talk to the two guys who really can answer that question, Dr. Norman Borlaug, my biggest hero on the planet, and Leon Hesser, who I also like. I'm Ben Gillette. I'm here with Michael Godeau. We might take a few phone calls, too. 866-570-PEN. That's 7366. We'll be right back. Yes. This is Ben Gillette in Las Vegas, Nevada, spending the whole break there just trembling with Michael Godeau, that we couldn't believe we were really talking to Dr. Norman Borlaug and Leon Hesser. A lot of you, I know, listen near computers. If you're near a computer, both Godeau and I have read the book, The Man Who Fed the World. Go to Amazon or wherever you like.
It's on Amazon right now and coming out to bookstores on September 5th.
We've got September 5th, but you should pre-order it, because if you pre-order it, then they make more of them and more people get to see it. And I think that anyone who doesn't know who Dr. Norman Borlaug is will want to know more. The book is called The Man Who Fed the World. The author is Leon Hesser, H-E-S-S-E-R. And we're talking to both of them on the phone. And I wanted to go, I'll give the phone number in case you want to call in and say that you were at least on hold while we were talking to Dr. Norman Borlaug. 866-570-PEN. That's 7366, and it's penradio@gmail.com. For both of you, you have, and I don't know the right way to put this, I know that when I think environmentalist, I think Dr. Norman Borlaug, but I do know that you have butted heads with people who call themselves environmentalists, and I also know that there's a great deal of controversy over genetically modified foods, which they call Frankenfoods, and I'd just like to have you talk about that, Dr. Borlaug, would you, a little bit? If you're still online, yeah.
I don't know, do we lose him? You guys there?
Norman, are you there?
He might have thought we were off.
Oh. Why don't we'll work on that in New York, and why don't you take that?
Well, it's been demonstrated, I think, pretty well that Dr. Norman Borlaug has saved hundreds of millions of lives from hunger and starvation. I think it can also be said that probably he has saved more habitat from destruction than any other person living. And that is because with his technology, we get the increases in yields without having to cut down more trees to clear more land to produce more food. So it's puzzling to me, and I think also to Norman, why the so-called environmentalists object to this marvelous technology that helps us increase yields and increase the quality of the food.
Are you on the line there, Doctor, now?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. The question I asked was, I said, although I consider you an environmentalist and the greatest environmentalist there is, you have, for lack of a better word, butted heads with some people who claim to be environmentalists, and there are people coming out against genetically modified food, and I just wanted to hear you talk about that a little bit.
Well, sure. I'd be glad to. For example, from the standpoint of land saved, talking about world cereal production, and that cereal grains are the number one item that is the basis of our whole food system, both for direct consumption, like in the case of rice or wheat, or much of it converted to animal products, is the case of maize or corn. In 1950, the total world production of all of the major cereal grains was about 620 million tons. By the year 2000, it was more than 1.900 million. In other words, about three times as much as it was in 1950. So, and that great harvest of the year 2000, was produced on 660 million hectares only, or if you want acres, you have to multiply by 2.5. I've lived in the third world so long, I think more in metric system. But the point is that we would have had to have cut down approximately three times as much forest or plowed up three times as much grazing land, probably poorly suited for agriculture, to produce the harvest of 2000 compared to the harvest of 1950 with the old technology. That's what the high-yield technology saved for Mother Nature, for those interested in wildlife, for all of us from the standpoint of keeping a favorable environment.
You brought up a point that I do want to tell people, and that is you're not someone who stayed in Iowa or at A&M University doing this research. How much of your life, you're 92 years old now, how much of your life have you spent in third world countries getting dirty?
I've spent 62 years in food deficit developing countries, with the exception of one semester of each year. For the last 20, I've been a visiting professor at Texas A&M. I'd like to point out also that I'm fairly well schooled in environmental issues and wildlife issues. I was trained a forester, worked for the Forest Service, lived in the most isolated areas of the world at one point in time, in the Middle Fork of the Salmon River in Idaho, the biggest primitive area for that time in the lower 48 states. And I have a good feel for wildlife. One of my secondary interests, as when I was in graduate school and I've maintained that. And I've continued to work with forestry groups on tree improvement, plantation improvement of trees to save land untouched in natural forest.
I just want to point out to our listeners that you saved hundreds of millions of people, and then you have secondary interests, which is which is just fabulous. I have a letter here I really think that a listener sent in. This is Dr. Borlaug. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and then she gives a URL, the world already produces enough food to feed every person in the world. However, many countries lack the money to buy this food. Do you believe this is true? Do you think something should be done about this? Thank you for your time. You are truly a great man. And that's from Grand Rapids, Michigan. So the question is there enough food right now to feed the world? Is the problem money or is the problem food?
It's both. There's probably enough food right now to feed the people at reasonable levels, but the problem is distribution. And I have never been interested in equitable distribution of poverty. You've got to produce something that's worth something to the general public before you worry about distributing it. Poverty is not one of those items. Food is. And this is where we forget that even in our own fluent USA society, you go down to some of the barrios of some of the low-income sections, and even now you can see hungry people. There are many reasons for those people being left behind. But if we had the will to change that, we could. We have the resources to do it. But in the third world, food deficit countries, they don't have these resources. But if we are interested in world peaceful or tranquil conditions for our sons and daughters and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, it won't be built on empty stomachs and human misery. And remember that when you have this widespread misery in many of the African countries and still in Asian countries, it's very fertile ground for planting seeds of disruption by extremists.
If you, what do you think? Well, you know, I'm going to wait till after a break for this because there's a few big topics I want to get to. I want to remind people that our guest is Dr. Norman Borlaug, 92 years old, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, and is considered by, I think, everyone to be the man who fed the world, and that's the name of the book by Leon Hesser. If you know the lyrics to one pop song that you've heard in your life, if you can recite the lyrics to any song done by the Beatles, done by anyone, anywhere, you know too much about music and too little about your world. Please learn about Dr. Norman Borlaug. It's a mind-blowing story, and it's amazing that we're sharing the same time with a man this great. We'll be back after this, 866-570-PEN, 7366. We'll be back talking to the man who fed the world, and he's taking time probably doing this show. He's killing hundreds of people that he didn't work on saving. We'll be back. Yeah, this is Penn Jillette at 866-570-PEN, 7366. You know, I said at the beginning of the show I was going to be taking calls, and we're not, because I'm so excited to be talking to Dr. Norman Borlaug that I'm simply greedy. And we also have Leon Hesser, who wrote the book, The Man Who Fed the World. Both Godot and I have read it. I don't know how it's possible that there are people in... It seems like if you know one name of one person alive today, the name should be Dr. Norman Borlaug. Because, you know, in a place... What I do for a living is talk, and nothing makes talk seem more empty than having Dr. Norman Borlaug on the phone. Doctor, are you still... working in the field and on this stuff, or have you finally retired?
Well, I'm still a part-time employee of three different organizations. One based in Mexico from January until the 1st of September. This is the Sasakawa African Association. It's funded by a Japanese foundation attempting to improve agriculture in the countries that have been left behind in food production. Second, I'm a consultant to the organization that I spent much of my life with, namely the International Maize, Corn, and Wheat Improvement Center, just outside of Mexico City. That was where this wheat technology was developed that was moved to the third world in the 60s. And I'm a part-time consultant to that organization. And in the fall semester, I'm a professor of international agriculture at Texas A&M. So I'm still active.
Yeah. So you haven't just packed up the Winnebago and driving around getting stickers at different national monuments. Will you explain to people, and maybe Leon, just so people know a little more about this, would you just talk a little bit about what BT wheat is and what golden rice is and how that stuff's put together and what the hopes are for that? Still there, Leon?
Yes. Sorry. I thought that Norman would answer that.
No, I think you should answer.
The golden rice is, through genetic engineering, the scientists have been able to introduce vitamin A. And in many countries, particularly in Africa, the people are deficient in vitamin A. It causes blindness and other kinds of things. This golden rice can solve that very, very easily. That's just one example of the kinds of research that can be done with genetic engineering and genetic modification.
I'd like to transmit one other possibility. For example, it's so-called rust fungi. These are fungi that attack all of our cereal crops except rice. For some reason, way back in there, development millions of years ago, when it split off from the same track of wheat and oats and barley and corn and millet and sorghums, it shut the doors on infection, became immune to the rust fungi, the puccinias. And this has been one of the main problems in breeding for disease resistance that has been carried on for decades. And generally, the longevity of a variety with resistance to the many different forms of these organisms that exist in different parts of the cereal-growing areas results in that they live, the varieties are useful for 10 or 15 years. The last ones that we put together, these high-yielding dwarf wheats that were used on the Green Revolution in India and Pakistan and in other parts of the world, have lasted 50 years with resistance. But there's a new strain now available or that appeared in Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya. If that gets loose, before we can change the varieties, there could be a disaster. And so one of my long-time hopes with the new biotechnology is take that resistance that's in rice and transfer it to not only wheat, but the other cereal grains where this is still a problem.
Now, the PR people for the people who are against genetic engineering use the term Frankenfood for genetically modified corn and, well, all crops. What would you say to someone who is saying we should not create Frankenfood, we should leave food natural?
Well, this is a ridiculous position that they've taken. If you look at this genetic makeup of the bread wheat, which constitutes more than 95% of all the wheat produced in the world, that is a natural cross that was done in prehistory by crossing wild wheat with two other grasses to produce the basic chromosome number that we are dealing with to further improve with genetic modification of the traditional time, and more recently with the modern transgenics. So this is a lot of nonsense, just like the same thing in organic versus chemical fertilizer. For God's sakes, I've always said, use all the organic fertilizer that's available, but don't come around the third world nations telling them that they can produce the food that's needed with organic fertilizer. We're using, in the case of nitrogen, more than 80 million tons a year. And if we tried to produce that with cattle manure, we would have to increase world cattle population by about sixfold, and then we'd have the problem of distributing this massive volume. It's a lot of nonsense. And this comes from people who have never produced one ton of food in their entire lifetime.
I'm on that list. I've never produced a ton of food in my lifetime either. I want to ask you, Norman, if the world were run the way I wanted, if someone said, Penn Jillette, you now have complete power over the whole world. You can get people to do what you want. I would immediately say, please give all my power to Dr. Norman Borlaug. If you had more power than you had in terms of the government and in terms of people's actions, what would you do to feed the world? What should all of us be pushing for to do the little bit that we can do to help people who are starving in other countries?
I would start with a broader picture than food. I would say the first thing I would like to see is universal primary education and, as soon as possible, secondary education. One of the problems at the present time, especially in the affluent nations like the USA and Western European countries, is that the major part of the population are urban. There's only 1 or 2% in rural areas. Most of those people after the second generation have lost their roots to the soil. They don't understand the complexities of feeding a population of now well past the 6 billion, going towards 7 billion. And this is where the problem comes. We don't spend our money, and you don't program our efforts to solve the really basic problems. We spend $900 billion, the world does, on military and armaments, but very little, by contrast, on food and agricultural production.
And a lot of your funding for the projects you've done over your lifetime has been corporations and private and not the government. Is that right? I mean, the Rockefeller and the Ford Foundation were really very helpful in the 60s of the Green Revolution. Is that right?
They were the pioneers that started this program in Mexico and in the Philippines. And from those, there were spun off the so-called Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research Centers, of which there are 16 now, but those are funded by many organizations. But the original funding, you were right, was by the two foundations, Ford, Rockefeller first, and Rockefeller Foundation, and then the Ford Foundation.
Well, Leon, I want to. We're starting to finish up here a little bit. How long did you work on the book, The Man Who Fed the World?
About a year and a half, 24/7. But I had known. I first met Dr. Barlog 40 years ago in Pakistan, and helped introduce his technology there, which led to the Green Revolution, and have followed his career ever since. So I knew about him and knew. You know, all the wonderful things he had done. So I didn't have to do as much research as somebody starting from scratch.
And what do you think, if when people, because people really should buy the book, The Man Who Fed the World by Leon Hesser, about Dr. Norman Borlaug, what would you like them to take away from the book? When they finish the whole thing, as Godot and I have, what do you want us to be remembering about your book 10 years from now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that Norman has done is develop high-yielding people as well as high-yielding varieties. In other words, in the centers that he's worked in Mexico and the same model was used to start centers in other parts of the world, there was a large training component. And so he's developed high-yielding people. And I think that his goal, and I would share that, would be to have young people interested in the food and the population and education problems of the world and become scientists or related endeavors that would help solve that problem.
So that's part of what the World Food Prize is meant to do, isn't that right?
Absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
And where do you think, what's the next breakthrough? I'll ask both of you, and I've got less than a minute now, so I'll be quick. What's the next breakthrough that's going to make your jaw drop? What's the next thing they're going to do in biotechnology that's just going to tell you, boy, we really can feed a lot more people?
Well, I think the ability to transfer genes across these borders where we couldn't, from different taxonomic groups, we don't know. We're hopeful that not only will we be able to increase better nutritional quality, better drought resistance, better cold resistance in certain cases, and better disease resistance, but we may actually find genes present in these wide crosses that we couldn't make before because of sterility that will give us a jump in yield further.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's no exaggeration. There's no hyperbole to say that I have never been more honored than talking to you, Dr. Borlaug. And thank you so much for taking time and letting those people starve when you should be working and being on our radio show here. Dr. Norman Borlaug, and the book is by Leon Hesser. It's called The Man Who Fed the World. And I have tears in my eyes just from being able to talk to these guys. This is Penn Jillette, Mike Godot. Thanks so much. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you.